What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Jordan Bush is the co-author of Thank God for Bitcoin: The Creation, Corruption, and Redemption of Money. Jordan is a missionary and church planter currently serving in Montevideo, Uruguay. He grew up in a Christian family, but it wasn't until his later years of high school that he came to believe the gospel and understand the implications of Christ's lordship over all things. That primary conviction deepened in university as he studied philosophy alongside the Judeo-Christian scriptures. Studying economic philosophy eventually led him down the Bitcoin rabbit hole. He is a husband, a father of four, and enjoys playing an ever-decreasing quality of basketball. Welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast, Jordan. How are you?
I'm doing well, Seth. Thank you.
Great to have you here. You know, I picked up the book right away when it came out. Jimmy and Robert have been on the show. I love the title. Kind of like almost like, thank God it's Friday. Thank God for Bitcoin, the creation, corruption, and redemption of money. I was just really excited about it. And when I got into it, I was digging it, and I just kind of turned to the back pages. And, you know, you kind of intrigued me right off the top of the bat. I kind of wanted to bring you in to talk about the book first. So I'm really excited to have you here, you know, and one of the things I just kind of want to get to know you a little bit better. So like, you grew up in a Christian family, but it wasn't later till you really kind of really, I guess, maybe dived in or took Christianity more seriously. And so what was Christianity like in your home? And what was that evolution like?
Sure. Yep. So my parents, my dad was a first generation Christian. Like, he grew up in a family where his dad was an alcoholic. And so just, I mean, just his, he just experienced that life. His dad would take him to the bar, you know, pretty much every night. And so he grew up there and had this small church, this very small, you know, church in the middle of the woods, basically just offered to come pick him up and take him to church. And so, I mean, he was one of a bunch of kids, and he has a bunch of brothers and sisters. And so just as kind of like, all right, let's just get him out of our hair. You know, he ended up going to this little church, and that's where, you know, he heard about Jesus. And so his life, once he got to middle high school, was just vastly different than his, you know, his experience. And so he's trying to figure out, I mean, not having any kind of Christian background, he's trying to find out, like, what does this look like to follow, you know, Jesus, just in a, you know, as a dad, not having had that. And, you know, how do you think through all these things? So I grew up in a situation where, I mean, I didn't have any of those kind of things that my dad experienced. And at the same time, I mean, it was, so my parents both work for this, an NGO, a nonprofit organization that basically tries to help kids and basically, you know, share with kids about Jesus. And they help, you know, they're in a bunch of countries all over the world. And so, so I grew up around, you know, around the church, around, you know, the Bible and all these things. And when I was a little kid, I really was into it, and really like, they did all these competitions to try to help kids learn, you know, Bible verses. And so I would like win all these trophies because I, you know, was really super competitive. And so I just remember, you know, I got to a point where, you know, grew up there, and then I started going to school, and there was nobody who was a Christian. And so I just realized I don't have any friends, and I just got to a point where I just really wanted friends. And so I just kind of started like distancing myself from, you know, the things of, you know, the church. And so it got to the point when I was about like 16, I remember my dad was trying to get me to just to like refocus in that direction. And he just was trying to get me to read the Bible for like 5 minutes a day and, you know, pray for a few minutes a day. And I just remember, you know, I have a Bible here, but I had a Bible, and I just remember I held the Bible. I was like, this book is stupid. Why am I going to waste my life with this stupid book that's worthless? And I just threw the Bible. And so, you know, my dad, I mean, didn't say anything, like, to his credit. Like, they weren't just trying to like force this down my throat. They just wanted me to appreciate what they had found that become so important to them. And so, yeah, so basically it was a few years later that I heard this, the message of Jesus, you know, that, I'd heard my entire life. Like, I'd heard the same message that, you know, Jesus had come to, you know, die for the sins of the world, and that he did it because he loved, you know, people. And so I could have told you that message. I could have shared with you, this is what it means to be a Christian. And I just didn't want to submit myself to that. I didn't want someone to tell me what to do. I wanted to go play basketball and, you know, get girls and do all those things. And, And so, yeah, so I knew these things were true on some level, but just didn't want to submit to them. And so I got to a point where I just heard this message and it was like lights turned on. And all of a sudden this message that I couldn't care less about before, literally in the span of moments, I just got to a point where I was like, man, this is the only thing I want to do. And so just for the rest of that was at like this youth camp thing. And so in the days and weeks that followed, I mean, I just would get by myself alone and just read the Bible, something that like, I just had never had any desire to do, you know, up to that point. And then all of a sudden, just in a moment, those desires were there. And so again, not like a perfect seamless transition, you know, there wasn't like this saint afterwards or anything, but I just had these new desires that I didn't have before. And so, yeah, that was kind of, that's in a nutshell, that's kind of where things started. And then so over time, those desires took me different places. So,
yeah, you said something that really interested me, but you were first. Yeah, I think your father was a first generation Christian.
Yeah.
And so that makes you like a second generation. But I don't usually think of Christianity or in America like that.
Yeah.
And do you think some of that push and pull was because you were second generation and maybe you were questioning your father's choices and whether he was right or not?
Yeah, no, I think it was more just like, again, I mean, you have other religions, you have like Judaism where it's this very historical, very family. I mean, just, it's incredible. Like there's somebody, I can't remember his name, one time said, what is the greatest evidence of the truthfulness of the Bible? And it's the existence of the Jewish people. Like there's, you see so many other cultures who existed thousands of years ago that are no longer here. And so the fact that like the Jew, you know, people of the Jewish faith took so seriously, you know, these things that God had told them about, you know, training up their children and teaching these things to their children. I think what I was wrestling with was like, what does it mean that my parents believe these things? And there's this whole world around me that doesn't. And that's another thing, like with the Jewish faith, it's so much cultural. And with Christianity, that part is there, but just in the specific day-to-day interactions that I was having in my school and stuff, there weren't people to like reaffirm those, you know, religious beliefs. And so I think that was the thing that I just was wrestling with was, you know, what my school culture is telling me one thing, and then my family culture is telling me another, and they're two warring, you know, belief systems. And yeah. And so for a long time, it was just hard for me to reconcile those two things.
Yeah. In terms of those two warring belief systems, do you think that's just a factor of, you know, life in America, and is that just like a normal thing, and is that like an impediment or an obstacle to certain people's development?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I've said this before, I think the hardest people to talk to about spiritual things and specifically about the Bible are not, you know, people who've never had any contact with those concepts and ideas. It's people who have had you know, contact in either, you were either really hardened by them, or they, I mean, suffered abuse at the hands of, you know, religious faiths or, you know, the church or whatever. I mean, people who've had bad experiences, those are the hardest people to talk to, because like they can't, and understandably, totally understandable, like the actual, you know, beliefs themselves about, you know, that the scriptures lay forward, they see those things, and those things are colored by the pain or whatever that they've experienced. And so I think that's part of it. I think another thing, like one of the things that they talk about just in describing the state of, you know, Christianity in the West, you have like, they call them like post-Christian cultures. And so you have these cultures that whether people like it or not, or individual people want to acknowledge it or not, like they were built on these, you know, they were founded on these Christian, you know, belief systems about, you know, what the world is like, about law. I mean, the entire Western world is built on, you know, the idea of the you know, Judeo-Christian, moral system. And so there's like these ghosts of the ghost of these religious faiths or these religious beliefs that are still, we still have. But I think, and this is part of the thing that fiat, I mean, I think fiat plays a big role in this, is for the last 50 years, you've had this disconnect between just more and more because fiat makes people have to work more hours, and it's really separated, had this really horrible effect on parents and children. And so I think that because of that, there's been this disconnect. And so over time, parents haven't been training up their children, and their children have this completely different daily experience than them, you know, being at school the majority of the day, and, you know, parents are off working and they're having to work super hard, being super tired. And I just think there's lots of forces that are warring and making it difficult for children to see their parents' experience as, you know, someone to imitate. I mean, I think that's a lot. There's a lot more to that, but I think that's got something to do with it.
Yeah, sure. When you, I don't want, you know, I'm going to choose my words carefully here, like evolved or found Christianity as you got older. Did that rekindle or add a new aspect to your relationship with your father and maybe your mother too?
Yeah, honestly, I mean, this is crazy, but like, so basically when I was 16, that kind of transformation kind of started. And then when I went to college, the only thing that my parents cared about was that I would go to like a Bible college for like a year. So there's basically one year where the nonprofit organization that they worked for has like one of the feature things that they do are these like Bible institutes where you go for a year and that's, you focus on that. And then after that, you can go off and study whatever you want to. And so for my whole life, like up until I graduated high school, I was like, I don't want to go do that. I wanted to go to like the University of North Carolina and study journalism, or the University of Syracuse and study sports journalism. That's, you know, really what I wanted to do with my life. And I knew my parents were going to make me do that. And so, I knew my parents were going to make me do that. I got to the end of high school. And right as I graduated high school, I had kind of like this experience again, where just the spiritual, I just saw again, the importance of the spiritual aspect of my life. And just the fact that my life's choices were going to have a huge impact on the way that my life went. I think so. And long story short, I ended up going to this Bible Institute. And so once I got there, I just the more that I spent time in the scriptures, the more that I just got to the point where I was like, man, this is really what I want to do with my life. Like this is just what I'm passionate about. And this is what I want to do. What was your question again? Like, I feel like I'm not.
Well, you kind of answered it. I asked about, you know, did it bring you closer to your father? That infers that you weren't close. So meaning maybe you were close. Did it bring you closer or did it add an aspect you didn't have?
Yeah. Forgive me. So there's two parts of that. Number one has to do with Bitcoin. I'll mention that in a second, but to answer your question, yes, it did. It did bring me closer to my parents a lot, because I feel like what happened in that, after that time period, and specifically when I went to this Bible Institute, was I feel like I experienced what my parents had experienced and like what had gotten them so passionate about spending their life, you know, helping people and sharing this message that had impacted them. And so when I got to this institute, every day you were studying the Bible for like 5 hours a day, which, I mean, to a lot of people, you're like, what on earth? Like, why would anyone want to do that? And again, the incredible thing is I will be the first to admit it's incredible. It's like, that's what I really enjoyed. I was waking up early to even, you know, read the Bible and pray more and stuff. And so I just remember throughout that year, I called my parents numerous times. And I mean, I'm not like, I am more of an emotional like person now, but like, I just would call my parents and just be in tears, asking them to forgive me for the horrible way that I treated them when I was in high school. Cause I really did. I mean, I just treated them like crap. I mean, just totally disrespectful, didn't care at all. Just was so sick of, you know, everything, and just treated them, but didn't respect at all just the love that they had for me. Just was totally focused on myself and my own life. And so there was numerous times where I just called them and just said, I was so wrong, you know? Yeah. So it really did bring us closer together.
I really see like a lot of circle of life kind of, you know, feeling here. And so at some point, you know, you find Christianity, and then you decide that it's not just for you, but that you want it to be your life's work. I think similar like your dad. Yeah. And so now you're a missionary and a church planter. And what is a church planter? I kind of know a little bit about a missionary. And when we talked a little bit before the show, I kind of got the idea of what a planter is, but if you could kind of elaborate on what a church planter is.
Yeah. So it's kind of interesting. And it's one of my favorite metaphors like to compare Bitcoin to, honestly. So basically the idea of a church planter planter is a plant. So basically you have this idea of taking a plant from one place, this thing that's this living being, this living, you know, this living growing thing, and moving it from a place where there's lots of those to a place where maybe there's not very many. And so one of the things that, I grew up around the church, but like my parents, because my parents worked for this organization that was affiliated with churches, but wasn't really a church itself. when I started studying the scriptures and I started seeing like involvement with a local church itself is something that the scriptures put a lot of emphasis on that hadn't necessarily been my experience growing up. That was just something that I started getting involved with. And so when we moved, I moved to Pensacola in Florida, we started getting involved with a small church that was, you know, newer. It only existed for 2 or 3 years. And so we started, you know, ministering and helping along that. And they were ministering in inner city context and helping people who, you know, didn't have very good home lives. And so the more that I lived and experienced and helped out in that atmosphere, the more I saw, man, like a local church is really suited to solve and to help with a lot of these things. You know, it's not just this service where you go once a week. You know, we had people who lived in this context who were coming in and out and trying to help people just with everyday needs. And so the more that I worked in that context, the more I saw, man, this is really what I want to do. You know, this, it's not about a building. It's not about, you know, the services and all this kind of stuff. It's just, was we're living here and we're just on a day-to-day basis, just kind of living our lives alongside of people and just trying to, you know, put ourselves in and minister to people in any way that we can. And so long story short, we found another nonprofit organization, a mission organization that basically does that around the world. They take, you know, they go to places in the world where there's not very many churches or church communities that are doing that kind of thing. And they take a group of people and they move them there. And then, so it's safer for the workers themselves. You've got, you know, you have community, because that's one of the hardest things about moving overseas is just, you don't know anybody. And so we moved overseas with a group of, you know, 5 or 6 other people and just started, meeting people and started, you know, when we had the opportunity, sharing, you know, about Jesus. And so over time, we had people who started to believe that and just kind of started to seeing how this message that, I mean, people in Uruguay, there's a lot of people who have some kind of background with the church. Sometimes it's the Catholic Church and that's not a good thing. Other times people do have kind of a better, you know, experience. But basically we just were kind of just studying the Bible alongside people. And so that's kind of what we've been done. That's what we've been doing. We moved this, you know, church community here and just kind of, it started to, you know, create itself. And so now we have, our church is basically constituted of about, you know, 50 to 60 people, families, you know, older people, younger people. It's kind of a good representation of, you know, what the city looks like. We have, I mentioned this in other podcasts, we have some Venezuelan immigrants who are about 30-40% of the church at this point. But yeah, so just seeing this intermingling of people from different cultures and backgrounds and, you know, economic situations, it's been really cool to see everybody kind of coming together and helping to serve each other.
Yeah. I grew up secular Jewish. Okay, but I've been fortunate enough to, I was bar mitzvahed. Kind of push and pull with that. My parents were secular as well, but sure. And then I was lucky enough to go to Israel a few times on a filmmaking trip, once on a birthright trip where I met my wife, on an educational trip. And I actually studied the Talmud in the evenings. Yep. I enjoyed the debates and, you know, it's interesting. I also got a chance to backpack the South Pacific by myself for a few months. Cool. And I was in Fiji. And I took a plane to a small, small island that gets maybe 1,000 visitors a year. Yeah. And I stayed at this remote, I don't even think you could really call it a hostel. They were just huts on the grounds. Okay. And I got to meet the homeowner and we got into a really interesting conversation where, you know, he was very fortunate when he graduated high school in Fiji to get an opportunity to go to serve in the Fijian army, which was because of the colonial relationship with the UK. He was able to get schooling in the UK, and he went to UK for a year, and he was actually, you know, excelling, but his home, you know, somewhere in his homeland, they were like, we need you and we need your skills to build a church. Okay. And if you come home and forego your life in England, you'll build the church here. And at the end of that, we'll reward you, not reward you in a bad way. Just, you know, and he got a piece of land, a beautiful piece of land. And that's his home. And he raised his family there. And, you know, one day, somebody, you know, who ran a Lonely Planet wandered onto his property and stayed there. And he built a business out of that. And, you know, we just had a very interesting conversation about life. And he, you know, was looking back on his life and really dissecting that opportunity he had. And there was a moment where he relished the on scene, but you could tell that he really had there was a lot of contentment with what he had done for the island and his people and the community. And I was always really fascinated by that. Yeah. And so I want to then, you know, now turn to, so you've been in Uruguay for, I think, 6 years now.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know if this is your first mission, you know, overseas. And and so, it, you know, whether it is or isn't, just like, what is it like? You got into a little bit, but like, how's it been? And kind of like, what is maybe like a day in the life after you've kind of built or planted the church?
Yeah. So basically, I mean, our experience is pretty crazy. I mean, honestly, like in some ways, I mean, it's your Montevideo is a big city. I mean, relative to, you know, Latin America. So Uruguay has about 3.5 million people and about 1.8 of them live in Montevideo. And so, I mean, we live downtown in the city. Oh, okay. And so, yeah. So it's like, when people think, like missionary, they think like huts, you know, and stuff.
Right. Well, when you said church planter, I didn't know if it was going to be rural, like your father.
Yeah, no. And so there's lots of people who do that. You know, there's lots of different groups who are working. But basically the reason why we actually moved to one of the, like the more, I mean, one of the wealthier parts of the city. And so what the reason why we chose this place, and there's a bunch of other, you know, nonprofit organizations that chose this place around the same time as we did as well, is because, I mean, this there's a city here, it's called Positos, which means little well. And so Positos has like the smallest number of churches out of, you know, per capita, like than almost any other place in the Western Hemisphere. There's one place in, you know, Paraguay that has something, it's comparable. But, and so the reason for that is because there's just wealthier. I mean, Jesus said that, you know, it's hard for the rich to inherit the kingdom. Basically, it's hard for you to see your, it's hard for you to see your spiritual need when you can, you know, by your own, you can meet all your own physical needs. And so, yeah, so Positos is this, you know, pretty comfortable, you know, wealthy place. And so, yeah, so basically, and so alongside that, so they're wealthier, so they have a more comfortable life, but at the same time, the rate of suicide and depression here is one of the highest in the entire Western Hemisphere. And so, so that was a lot of what kind of drew us here. I mean, like I dealt with, you know, like anger and depression for a lot of my life growing up. And especially when I for like my second year of college, I really just like wrestled with, you know, those things. And so, you know, having seen how both my faith itself and then just other people who believed, you know, that same message, how like they kind of rallied around me. I had two people who really, during those really hard times, you know, rallied around me and were there to just be like, hey, you know, can we just help you? Can we just, you know, be with you? And that really helped me a lot. And so knowing that there were people in Uruguay who were in a very similar situation, that was part of the thing that drew us here. And so, yeah, since we've been here, so like a day in the life, basically it's taken a lot of different, you know, courses, a lot of different things. At this point, about a year ago, we combined with another small church as well. We were a small church around 25, 30 people. And we're sharing a building with another church just so we didn't need to, you know, receive a bunch of donations. Like that's been one of the things that we're most proud of, is like, we've given many times more than we've ever received from anybody, any of the people who are part of the church, which kind of has been something that separates us apart from, there's lots of like these Brazilian prosperity religions where they, you know, say God's going to bless you if you give us money. And right. So we just wanted to like get as far away from that idea as possible. And so, yeah, so basically we were sharing a building, and then that church for different reasons had to go a different direction. And so we were, long story short, we combined with another small church. And so, yeah, so it's been awesome. I mean, there's three of us who are kind of helping. There's two specific pastors, and then I'm kind of like a missionary, you know, pastor. And so, yeah, it's just been a day in the life, is just, we meet with people, we do counseling, you know, whether it's, you know, marital or just individual counseling, you know, people who are in similar situations, kind of what I was describing. And then, you know, just preparing, you know, like doing teaching, doing sermons, like all those kind of stuff. There's a little bit of everything, doing paperwork, you know, like we kind of have to live in two different countries at the same time. Mm. You know, we have people and stuff in the United States, and so we're keeping contact with them. And so there's a little bit of everything. And then just, again, I'm a dad and a husband. And so, you know, we just had our fourth kid, you know, welcomed him a few, few months ago. And so just trying to give, you know, kids, you know, the time that they need and, sure. you know, recognizing that they're not in a normal situation. And so just a little bit of everything.
Yeah. Well, Mazel Tov on the 4th.
thank you.
So how did you find Bitcoin and how did Bitcoin find you in this very exciting dynamic experience you're having?
Yeah. So it's so funny because I know, like, for most people, like, there's, first of all, there's like the missionary thing. And then there's like the missionary Bitcoiner, like what in the world? And so I think a lot of it, I first heard of Bitcoin in 2012, 2013. I walked into a broker, silver and gold broker dealer, just trying to like buy some silver coins, walked past the desk of this girl who had a Bitcoin sticker. And I just started talking to the guy who was running the place. And I was like, is this Bitcoin? Like, I've heard of that. And he's like, yeah, it's pretty crazy, you know? And he's like, I don't know if you'd be interested in that at this point, you know, just, it's so new. And so by looking at it back, I think Bitcoin is like $100, $200 or something. I'm like, oh my word, I wish I would have just bought. and so that was kind of my first touch. And then most, like most people, the first touch wasn't enough. And so it was around 2017 when the price started to spike that I kind of frantically trying to create an account on Coinbase, you know, with a VPN from Uruguay. And, but yeah, it really wasn't that I didn't really kind of look into the why of Bitcoin and the thinking behind it until, you know, early 2019, when it started to kind of climb again. And so really there's a several different factors that kind of really kind of affected me. One was just, I've always been just asking the question, why, like, why does this look this way? Like, why do you believe what you believe? Why does this thing exist? How does it work? And so, like, it was around that time where I started looking into, like, what is Bitcoin? Like, why does it exist? I had had interactions with Austrian economics via, you know, Ron Paul primarily, and really just came to believe in that. And so then once I started looking into the philosophy behind Bitcoin, it just, that was the thing, like that. I was just like, man, I wish I'd found this before. I wish there had been the Breedlove, you know, or these other guys who are, you know, putting these ideas out there, the Pierre and Bitstein, like, man, I wish I had found these guys earlier. And so that kind of started me down the path. And then also just seeing, like, as I'm reading and studying about it and just seeing the effect that fiat money has had on different cultures, like, that was the second thing that just kind of put its hooks in me. Because, like I said, we have Venezuelan immigrants in our church who, you know, had to leave everything because their government has, you know, obliterated their currency by printing it. And then right across the river from us is Argentina, and their currencies failed 4 times due to similar things. And so just those two very, you know, punctual things that are part of my day-to-day life, the Uruguayan peso, like, since we arrived 6 years ago, the peso has lost half its value, you know, lost 100% of its value. It was, you know, 24 pesos to $1, you know, 6 years ago, and now it's about 43. So, I mean, just seeing, it's a day-to-day reality. I see these things working themselves out. And so the combination of those things working together, the philosophical and then just the practical day-to-day, I just was like, man, I have to do something about this, both for, you know, for our own self. Just, I was trying to find something to invest in, and I'm not a very, you know, smart, savvy investor. I just know that you're supposed to buy low and sell high. And when every, you know, every other investing vehicle is literally at all-time highs, I probably shouldn't be buying those things. And so I guess it's the three of those things working themselves together are what kind of drew me to Bitcoin.
Sure. While we're at it with Venezuela, like, I'm curious, and again, I don't expect you to speak for all of Venezuela and everything that's happening, but just anecdotally, I'm more interested if you've heard anecdotes around people trying to get their wealth out of Venezuela, you know, whether just through the border, not so much because of what happened with their money with inflation, but have you heard stories about, and not whether they used Bitcoin or not, but just what have you heard around people trying to?
Yeah, we have people from our church who, I mean, have crossed the border, you know, on foot illegally. Like, I mean, the border's shut down right now. And I mean, so you can kind of go through the woods at, you know, nearby these official checkpoints, and there's police there, and you have to bribe the police in order to, you know, let them, you know, let you out. And so we know people firsthand who've done that. I mean, it's crazy, honestly. Like, I mean, you have women who are going by themselves. And I mean, just, you know, as a dad and as a husband and as somebody who knows these people, it's just, you just, it just hurts you. And just, like, it weighs heavy on you to know that, like, you could have some guy who just doesn't care and, you know, who just, you know, rapes, you know, one of these girls, like, that could totally happen. So yeah, just to answer your question, we've totally heard of that. And, Yeah, it's happening. It's
have real. You seen anything? I don't know if you have access to Venezuela or been there, but like, have you seen, you know, or heard about empty shelves in supermarkets or, you know, those kinds of things?
Yeah. We've talked to people. I just was talking to a guy, one of the guys in the church the other day. No, it wasn't a guy from the church. There's another friend of ours who's Venezuelan. He came here a few years before everything got really bad. And he was talking about how I was explaining to him about Bitcoin just as a way, because he had to pay something like, I want to say 8 or 9% in order to send money back to Venezuela via, you know, a broker here. And so as we were talking, he's just saying, I asked him, you know, when they go to the store, like, what's it like? And he said, yeah, he goes, everything's in dollars. Like, the prices are in dollars, but they can't put the dollar. It's just a number there. So it'll say like 3, 4, you know, with no denominator. But like, everybody knows, like, but they can't do it. They can't officially put dollars because that's illegal. And so it's just this whole disaster where everyone knows the game that's being played. They know the game that they have to play, but at the same time, they can't do it above ground because the government will make a stink. So.
Right. And you mentioned before, so in like around 2014 or so, you were looking for silver coins.
Yeah.
It was just an inflation hedge. You were just scratching an itch or
again, I'd heard Ron Paul, you know, in 2010, I'm like, where were the Bitcoin ads? Like,
right.
Like, where were the people who could have helped me? But so 2010, I was just kind of, you know, it's actually so funny. Like my economic, you know, evolution, you know, is very simple, followed those kind of lines. So it was like, Ron Paul, Glenn Beck was like, you know, more libertarian in those days. I was in college. I knew nothing about politics. I just studied the Bible and philosophy and, you know, knew some about politics, but hardly anything. And so that was kind of the route that I followed. And so, yeah, so you see gold advertisement, silver. And so I was convinced that, you know, inflation was coming and, you know, was looking for those things, right, as inflation hedges. So, yeah.
Now, I'm not going to make a direct comparison. I don't think Bitcoin is religion, but it can be religious, religious, or, you know, but I'm wondering, like, you know, when you were learning about Christianity or more so the second time, and then with like, with Bitcoin, were there any kind of like parallels on that learning path?
Yeah. So, I mean, just the individual, I mean, the sense of responsibility, you know, like the sense of like individual responsibility, just the fact that, I mean, people don't just, people are, the family is like this, the most basic unit of society. Right. And so like, you have to have, I mean, family has to have a wide berth in terms of what they can and can't do. I mean, like that's the first unit of government is the family. And so libertarianism kind of, you know, fit dovetail with that. A lot of libertarian principles of like, I mean, people have to be free, you know, like people have to be free to make their own decisions. And so if, you know, families, parents can't make decisions for their children, really, they can't lead their families in the way that, you know, the scriptures expect parents to, you know, kind of lead their families. So yeah, there's definitely a lot of overlap there. I think the more that I study the scriptures, I mean, like, I just saw a lot of libertarian, you know, principles. Like, I mean, just in the Old Testament, this is a longer rabbit trail that we won't go into, but just sometimes people think of like the Old Testament and they think of like a theocracy. And so, but like one of the things that you see is like God warns the Israelites about the downside of having a king is that he's going to need to charge taxes. And so he's like, you're going to have to give like 10% of your money. Like what you would otherwise just be able to keep and use, like you're going to have to do that. And so it just was a crazy mind bender for me as I'm just seeing, you know, just a 10% tax, God's presenting this as like this really thing that should motivate you not to want a king. I think for a lot of people, what they have is like, they have like this, it's like a surface level interaction with the scriptures, and it's just enough to be, it's just weird enough and just like foreign enough. And then there's enough cultural Christianity, you know, American Christianity, like there's enough of that where it just completely turns them off and they don't go deeper to kind of look at the scriptures themselves. And so really ironically, like the more that I kind of dove into the scriptures themselves, the more I was like, man, there's like these principles are everywhere. You know, the idea that like even kings, like even the kings in the Old Testament, they couldn't just do whatever they wanted to. Like, they were bound by the law. You have the story of one crazy story, the story of, you know, David and or Daniel in the lion's den, where you have this king, you know, Darius, who basically gets this his little henchmen get this law passed where, you know, if you pray to anyone but him, then you have to be thrown into the lion's den. And so they catch Daniel praying, and they go to the king. And they're like, look, king, like, you passed this law and he's doing this. And it doesn't say, you know, Darius just said, well, forget it, we'll just change the law. It says, no, like, the law was passed. The law, the written law, was a big deal. And so Daniel had to suffer the consequences. And so, like, I just look at that. And I mean, even in context where there's a king on the throne, the king couldn't just do whatever he wanted to. There were limits to the power of the king. And so when I step into the American context and I see governments that literally are acting like gods, where there's no limit to their power, literally, I mean, just Patriot Act, whatever you want to look at, you know, the Federal Reserve, like, they have unlimited ability to create money. Like, those are the kind of things where I, as a Christian, I look at that and I'm like, governments aren't gods. Like, governments have to acknowledge their people. There's limits to their authority. And where governments fail to recognize their, you know, the limits on their authority, like, they fail to have authority. And so that's kind of my evolution. In the more that I found,
right,
as I'm looking at Bitcoin, I just realized, like, yeah, Bitcoin just is a check on, you know, government, you know, authority that they don't actually possess. So
is Bitcoin king, or is that a little maybe offensive to a Christian? And I ask that, you know, I want to back it up a little bit. Like, you know, I have a really hard time. Like, I think you do too. And, like, you know, like, nobody should be king.
Yeah.
Right. Or have rules that are beyond what a king should have. Yeah. You know, I kind of frame that up as, like, I would never wear another man's name on my back of my shirt.
Sure.
You know, but in some ways, and I listened to the conversation on Noted with I think most of you, except for Breedlove and Derek. Yeah. And there was this conversation about how it's kind of not debatable that Jesus existed.
Yeah.
And this was really interesting to me, that he's not. The way that was framed up, and I don't know if it was you or maybe Lyle, I'm not sure, but it was framed up as Jesus is king based on the fact that we're still talking about him.
Yeah.
So that, and that the calendar and the world revolves around him,
sure,
which was a different angle or perspective to me than just pure maybe religion or scripture.
Sure. And so that was George who said those things. And so, again, like, what you see there is kind of, I mean, we have, like, a bunch of different backgrounds, like, among the authors, you know, themselves. Sure, and so, yeah. Again, like, a lot of that, I mean, there's been a lot of different experiences like that we all bring to the table. And so, I mean, I'm not going to speak for George. Like, George has had, sure, you know, certain experiences. And I think I think he would be the first one to say, like, that shaped kind of how he sees things. And so I wouldn't necessarily, like, agree with, like, that being the only, you know, that being,
yeah, I wasn't trying to say the only, but it was an interesting perspective. Sure.
Yep. I think what he said is true, you know? I mean, yeah. Like, the fact that we're still talking about this guy who claimed to be God and I mean, claimed to rise from the dead. And I mean, just trying to make sense of that is crazy. Yeah. When they were this persecuted minority, I mean, like, there's a lot of things there that, I mean, really are, I mean, you have to really wrestle right with that. I think that is really true.
There was a lot to unpack there. One of the things that, you know, like Pierre even said, like, you know, there's a lot of evidence that Jesus existed, that, you know, he doesn't have a historical truth verification node, but, sure, you know, and I think it was Julia who was talking about there's more evidence and cross-reference and evidence from Jesus' enemies than maybe, I forget the other reference, Alexander the Great, you know. So one of the other things I wanted to ask you about is, what do you make of, you know, like what I'll call, like, the Immaculate Conception of Bitcoin? Yes. You know, yes, it's the first, but also, and then just tie in the disappearance of Satoshi, which is, has some parallels to maybe Jesus of life, you know, in some regards, coming and going.
Yeah. There's so many, honestly, Cedric, like, there's so many things where I'm like, I honestly don't know what to make of this, because there's just so many things. Like, I want to do, like, a blog post at some point where kind of I just lay out, like, I mean, I've said a few of them on Twitter. You've probably seen some of them. I've shared some of them, but, like, there's a ton. I mean, like, there's so many. So one of the things is, I mean, yeah, you talked about, and kind of comes out of nowhere. I mean, this immaculate, you know, conception, this, you know, creation out of nowhere, ex nihilo kind of, you know, this guy just appears. I mean, Satoshi, I mean, this is, again, like, joking, but you just look at it. I mean, he kind of, he ministers for 3 years and then disappears. You know, Jesus's ministry lasted 3 years. And there's like all these like little weird coincidences. Like he left it in the hand of like his disciples, you know, there's like all these things that are just really interesting, you know, that I'm not saying like this is, you know, God behind this, but like there's another one is, I mean, yeah, like you look at, so like when Moses was leading the people, the Israelites, like he led them to the edge of the promised land. And, but then Moses basically sins and he basically, because he's, you know, he's a leader, he's held the higher standards and basically God doesn't let him go into the promised land. He just gets to like look in. And so you look at Satoshi, like he comes up with this awesome invention. He brings, you know, the world to the precipice and then he doesn't actually get to go in, you know, and enjoy it. And so that's another one. I mean, there's just a ton of them. Like
those are interesting.
Yeah. I have a bunch of them, but I just want to like write them all. But I mean, I just look at it. Yeah. I mean, I, one of the things is just like the finite nature of Bitcoin. Like that's just another thing where, there's only a certain amount of them. One of the principles, and we talk about this in the book, one of the principles that's just from the very beginning of the scripture is this idea of sowing and reaping, you know, this idea of, you know, you reap what you sow. Like there's correlation, like there's different, it's called different things. Like that's called karma, you know, in some religions, but you know, in, you know, karma is more impersonal in the, monotheistic or in theistic religions, it's a personal force. Like there's, you know, it's a personal, there's someone there who's bringing these, you know, who's giving justice and whatever. And so I think like that's something with Bitcoin, especially when you compare it to a system where, I mean, the fiat system completely denies sowing and reaping, you know, like debt is just money we owe ourselves. There's really no consequence. Like it's just such a farce. And so when you compare that with Bitcoin, like where Bitcoin basically says, yes, actions have consequences. You know, there's, in order to get Bitcoin, you have to invest, you know, you have to sow in order to reap Bitcoin, like those kind of principles, as, you know, as somebody who, you know, subscribes to, you know, Christianity and, you know, believes those things. I just see that that's a very important principle. And so, I mean, there's a lot of things, but that's one place. I mean, another, one of my favorite things, I don't think I've talked about this, in any other place. One of the scriptures that comes up a lot with Christian Bitcoiners is the one where the Pharisees are trying to trip up Jesus and they say, you know, who, you know, basically should we pay taxes to Caesar, you know, or not? You know, it's basically trying to catch him. Cause if he says one thing, if he says, no, you don't have to pay taxes, well, they can go to the Romans and say, hey, this guy's, you know, a tax rebel. He's trying to incite, you know, tax rebellion. And then they can go kill him. The Romans will kill him. And if he says yes, well, then he's going to be in favor, you know, with the people. He's going to make them pay taxes. And so what Jesus says, he just completely plays them is, you know, whose likeness is inscription is on this coin. And then he basically says, give to God, you know, give to Caesar what Caesar's, give to God what's God's. And contrary to, you know, people say, like, that's not, Jesus is not advocating policy. Jesus is not saying like everyone needs to pay no matter what the tax is. Like this is, that is not the point that Jesus is trying to make. Like what Jesus revealed is the Pharisees, they didn't care about money. They literally wanted to kill Jesus, like murder. They were willing to murder, you know, if it meant, you know, they were willing to say whatever and do whatever in order to get rid of Jesus. And so what Jesus wants to point out to them is, like, so you're so focused and worried about like physical money when he's like, you are God's money. Like you are made in God's image, you're God's money. And so like, I hadn't ever put that idea together. And so like, as I meditated on that, like I've got this, you know, article that I'm like 90% done with it. And I'm sure you as a creative person, like you're like, I want it to be perfect, whatever. But so that I just am like talking about that idea that, I mean, like people are made in, like one of the ideas that the scriptures lay out is that people are made in God's image. And so like, what does that mean? And basically what it means is like, people are God's money. Like people are God's store of value. Like God, the most valuable, the scriptures present like God's character and who he is. Like God himself is like the most valuable thing in the universe. And so like, where does God store that value? He creates humans, you know? And so as we look at like money, like Bitcoin is not God. Bitcoin is not king. You know, Bitcoin, like money is made to be a tool that's leveraged and used to be a blessing to people. It's designed to provide a fair and equitable, you know, resources for to that, you know, facilitates trade between people, allows people to love their neighbor and give them fair value. And so, you know, so many, I said this on another place somewhere, that basically, like, when you look at most law systems, like, why is theft wrong? You know, why is extortion wrong? Why are Ponzi schemes illegal? Like, why are these things all illegal? It's because they all say that people are more important, or that money is more important than people. And so when I, like, the reason why Bitcoin, you know, I see the value of it is because it's this thing that puts, it puts money back in this place where it's this tool to be used, and not this all encompassing, we live to serve this thing. And so when, and this is just deflationary currencies in general, like, if, like, if your money is maintaining value, that means you're going to have to work less. You're going to have the ability. It's not going to, there's obviously, there's going to be people who, who just continue there. They want to accumulate more money. You can't do anything about that, but it allows people who want to have a more balanced life, who want to spend more time, you know, serving their communities and their families, it's going to allow them to have that much more margin, you know, and that's, and I see that as being, that's the way that God designs the world to work. You know, like, when you sow, when you plant a seed, the idea is that you plant a seed, you do the work up front, and then you reap a tree that produces fruit. And so you get, your efforts are multiplied. And so I just see that as, like, this is this principle that God has built into the world. And Bitcoin is one tool that, you know, is more aligned with the reality that I see God, you know, creating into the world.
Is, you know, is Bitcoin possibly a gift from God in the way that maybe gold was a gift from God and that fiat's not? Or is it kind of like, you know, I've heard a rabbi once told me, you know, if someone hits you, they might not have been right to hit you, but you might have needed to get hit for some other reason. Yeah. And the world is perfect. You know, try to get what the message is, even though you might have a disagreement with that individual and they shouldn't have hit you.
Sure.
So you could say everything is gift, everything's perfect, but, or, you know, is Bitcoin something like a gift from God, like gold would be considered? Sure. I'm not saying you consider gold to be a gift from God.
Yeah, no, I do think, I mean, I do think, like, the properties of gold made it, again, it can mean, so the scriptures lay out, Old Testament, New Testament lay out, or, you know, First Testament, Second Testament, like, they lay out that, like, Jesus says, if you want to sum up the entire scriptures, it's love God with all your heart, your soul, your mind, and your strength, and love your neighbor. And the second one that's on the same level, you can't do one without doing the other, is love your neighbor as yourself. And so, like, knowing that those are the laws, like, those are the two priorities with which God created the world. Like, what that means is those are the two things that God wants. And so, like, when you see, is laid out in the scriptures, both, you know, in the Old Testament, and just, you see God is constantly coming out and hammering those who institutionalize injustice and institutionalize and bring about the suffering of the poor and the widow, you know, and the stranger. Like, those are clearly antithetical to what it means, like, to what God's will is for the world. And so, like, I do think that, like, God he's committed to his will being done. And so he's using events, you know, he's using inventions, ideas that come out. He's always got kind of like a check on the evil that's going on in the world. It doesn't mean that the evil things won't happen, but there's not, like, I do think, like, God is overseeing the events of the world. He's not going to let things get to, like, a certain point where the whole world just is destroyed. You know, like, he's not allowing it. Like, there's local or even, you know, international atrocities that happen. And that, like, those are, like, the problem of evil. Those are real things and real difficult things to wrestle with. But I do think, like, God is over history, kind of making sure that it gets to this place that he wants it to get to. And so in that way, I do think that, I mean, like, when you look at the suffering going on in the world as a result of fiat currencies and the unlimited power that it gives to governments, I mean, like, just the scale of suffering that's been able to happen, and just the destruction of families, you know, by dividing families, kids spending all day away from their parents and parents not being able to really, you know, build into their children in the way that they have throughout human history. I mean, like, those things, I just think, I do see, I really think that, again, if I think this is what, one of the reasons why Bitcoin exists is God's just like, enough. God only allows evil to prosper for so long before he just says no. And that's a, I think it's a merciful thing. I think, and so, and that's a, I would say it's a gift. You know, I would say it's a gift. I wouldn't say it's, you know, in the same, it's not on the same level as, you know, to me, like Jesus is obviously, because again, like Jesus, like when Jesus came, there's a whole bunch of people who like, they rejected him because he wasn't the political, and like economic immediate savior, you know, that like, you know, people who like the Jewish, you know, people were expecting. And like his point in doing it wasn't that, wasn't saying what you're going through is great and easy. No, not at all. But what he's saying is like, his point is like, if I could deliver you from the physical, you know, the physical suffering that you're going through, which had happened all throughout the Old Testament. He's like, I could deliver you from the physical difficulties that you're going through, but without, like, without really dealing with, you know, the concept of sin, you know, like this thing that the desire to live for oneself instead of God and one's community, like until that's dealt with, all these other things are just temporary, you know, fixes. So I see Bitcoin as being very helpful in like the day to day, but like, it's not going to change the fact there's going to be people who love Bitcoin and love any kind of money more than they care about their needs of their communities. Yeah. You know,
forgive me if I'm overstepping my skis here, but could Bitcoin, or, you know, be considered prophecy, you know, form an extension of prophecy? Is it prophetic?
It's so crazy.
Does prophecy continue past, you know, Abraham and Moses and Jesus?
Yeah. It's honestly, like, it's funny you say that, because I mean, like, I sent this to Jimmy or Breedlove, was just like, one of the ways that prophecy works is that like God reaches out to like either an individual or a small group of people and shows them like the future. And the reason why he does it is so that those people, when the difficulty comes, they'll know this is what God told us is going to happen. It's going to get hard. And so, but his purposes are going to be fulfilled in the end. And so one of the things I was literally just thinking, like, man, the fact that we know like the release schedule of Bitcoin, like it allows you, again, not perfectly because no one knows the events of their life, but it allows you to plan, you know, it allows you to make decisions, you know, in a way that is more, it just allows you to plan further. It allows you to think into the future and kind of plan with those things in mind, which can be a dangerous thing. You know, like, again, presuming that you know what's going to happen in the future, like the scriptures are clear, like you shouldn't do that. And at the same time, you're also told not to be, you know, you're told to be like the ant. You know, the Proverbs say that we should be like ants, you know, who are preparing for the future. And so I do think there's a sense in which, I mean, Bitcoin promotes low time preference thinking, which is, I mean, such a stark contrast with the modern, you know, with like what fiat money does. And so I wouldn't say maybe it's not prophecy in the strict sense, but I do think it can serve a similar function to what prophecy, you know, does.
Sure. I appreciate that. I want to turn to the book a bit. Before we do that, I want to set the table. You know, and again, you know, I love the book. I would have taken the book again as just really a Bitcoin book based in morality. I wouldn't have seen it as a religious book, but, you know, I recognize the title. I recognize the group that was brought together, and I've heard you guys speak on it a little bit. I was listening to Robert Breedlove and Jimmy Song on Stefan Levera, and they both had a very...
Can you hear me? You said...
You just froze up for a second. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So they both had a very different view on who the book was for, which is sort of natural and organic. They're both writing for a different audience, but, you know, they're still trying to write for the same audience at the same time. But I think Robert was thinking like, oh, maybe, you know, a 20-year-old college junior who's in a fraternity will read this book and come to terms with Bitcoin, maybe through the morality or Judeo-Christian lens. And Jimmy, I think, was more looking at maybe the soccer mom, you know, and trying to get through to her. And what all that really said to me is, you know, the book is just rooted in understanding money and how corrupt it's gotten and trying to bring money back in from a morality perspective. And rooted in Judeo-Christian narratives. And so I'd love to get into some of those narratives because they're just historical stories we've been telling ourselves for generations. But before that, just to set the table a little bit, I'd love to ask you, like, what is Christianity?
Yeah. So basically, again, we mentioned this right before we started. I think one of the misnomers is that, I mean, especially, I mean, yeah, I mean, just one of the misnomers is basically, I mean, God from the beginning in the Old Testament, you know, like his plan is that the whole world is filled with people. Like he creates humankind. They're supposed to, you know, like carry out his will in the world. And so the idea of that was, I mean, it's kind of rooted in this. Basically, the idea is that when there's people, kings in the ancient world, what they would do is they would like put statues of themselves at like the far reaches, at like the borders of their territory. And so what basically that would do, this happened in like Egypt and stuff. And so you'd find like the statue of Pharaoh at the very, you know, end of the Egyptian territory. And that would show you, when you saw that, you knew you were entering into the territory of, you know, this leader. And so basically people were made in God's image. God had created the world. And so he wanted people to fill the whole world so that like the whole world basically points to who, you know, who the creator is. It's basically, it's kind of a weird idea, but that's basically what God's, you know, kind of trying to do. And so from the beginning, basically his plan gets kind of, you know, temporarily frustrated. And so then basically humanity goes astray. And then basically God, again, in the Christian understanding of these things, basically God chooses Abraham, chooses this one family, and basically tells him right from the beginning, like, through you, Abraham, the world is screwed up. Like the world's messed up. And Abraham, I want to bless you. And he basically says, and through you, I'm going to bless the entire world. And so the idea is that God is going to bring back the world, and the world and people are going to carry out the God's initial plan. And that the way that's going to happen is God's going to choose a small segment, and he's going to like just reveal himself to them. And then those people someday are going to go out and they're going to tell the rest of the world of, you know, what he's doing. And so that, you know, Christianity basically sees, you know, Jesus as this, you know, this one, this leader who's going to come, who's going to be the king to make everything right. The Jewish understanding of it is the, you know, Mashiach, or the Messiah. So we see basically Jesus as this promised one who God promised in the beginning. And so he's come to basically invite the entire world to be part of God's family. And so, you know, that's basically what it is to be a Christian. The term Christian was not chosen by like the followers of Jesus themselves. It was kind of like this derogatory thing. Cause like Christian just means little Christ. And so it's like, hey, look at those little Jesuses over there. Like they walk just like him. They do what he did. They're just the little Jesus people. And so it's ironic that, you know, that's what we're known as. So basically when I think about like what it is to be a Christian, like it's just being human. Like a Christian is just someone who is trying to imitate Jesus, who was the prototypical human, who in everything, like he laid down his life every day of his life to serve his neighbor, and surrendered every right that he had in order to carry out, you know, his father's will. And so when I think of a Christian, it's basically imitating Jesus. It's living your life as a servant of God and a servant of people. And so again, when I look at the world, I'm not here to make Jordan's name great. I'm not here to demand my rights. I'm here to, you know, imitate Jesus by laying down my rights in serving others, whether it's, you know, the poor, whether it's, you know, my family, you know, whatever it is. It's, I see myself as I'm put here to serve, and to imitate, you know, Jesus who did that. Sure. As well.
Yeah. And I have a couple more questions. And again, I just want to preface that, you know, when I ask you a question about Christianity, my assumption here is that everyone knows that you're speaking for yourself and not, yes, you know, every single sect, and it's not definitive. And
it's impossible
for myself.
To do.
Yeah.
It's impossible
but to do that. I'm trying to, you know, table set here a bit, because I want to explore, you know, the morality of money and the redemption of money. Yeah. Yeah. So, and I want to kind of grasp, you know, and ground what the viewpoint was coming into the book. So another thing I want to ask you about Christianity is, you know, what is sort of like the view on the individual versus the collective?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's one of the really difficult things. I mean, most cultures tend to, you know, go to extremes. And so like you'll have, typically historically, like Eastern cultures are they're much more collective. You know, the family is everything. The extended family is everything. And you see a lot of that in Latin America, some, you know, different parts of Latin America. Whereas the West is more individualist. Like they put a lot more, there's a lot, give a lot more importance to the individual. And the, what I see in the scriptures is like both of those things are true. And it's difficult to like have those things, you know, be in tension with each other. And so, I mean, you have individuals are important. You have, I mean, like Jesus tells the story of the shepherd who leaves the 99 to go save the one, you know? And like, I mean, we do, you're like, man, that seems like, I don't know if I would do that. You know, it doesn't seem like a very good economic decision. You know, you're putting the 99 at risk to get the one. And so, you know, but in the West, we understand that more, you know, we're more open to that. Well, of course, it's amazing. Like when you see during war conflicts, you'll have one guy down behind enemy lines and they'll send out, you know, they'll risk the lives of 12 guys to go save this one. And so it's amazing how you see that this underlying belief just work itself out. Whereas, you know, I mean, just, I'm trying to think of an example. I'll say like one of the things that you have, I've heard like interviews with people who've talked with people in the Islamic faith. And so in the Islamic faith, the collective, like the family and how one basically it's an honor culture. And so like, if you bring shame upon your family, they're justified in killing you, you know, like, and again, like for in the West, you're like, what in the world? But in that, like their view of what it is to be human, like is the family is much more a part of that. There's, and that's true in some extent, but like it gives explanatory power to some of these things, the worldviews that seem so different. It's because we have different understandings of what it is to be human. And so with Christianity, yeah, there is a lot of that intention. It just throughout history, you see different, you know, it works itself out in different ways. Right. But yeah. So again, I think those two things are intention but they're both very important. They're both important on, in the Christian faith.
Yeah. And how did the book come together?
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, again, I feel like I was the last one to join the book, you know, group. They'd been Jimmy and what's his name? Jimmy and George had met at a conference and realized that they're both Christians. And they just said, hey, like, let's just start, you know, studying some scriptures together. And so they just started reading different scriptures. And then, you know, over time, they just invited different people in, Julia, you know, Turiansky and, you know, Lyle. And they just basically started, you know, adding them one at a time. and then they started, after reading the scriptures, different scriptures, and doing like Bible studies, they basically started reading The Ethics of Money Production by Guido Holzman. And then they reread Honest Money by Gary North. And so it was at the tail end of the Guido Holzman book, The Ethics of Money Production, that I got introduced to them, and they invited me to come, you know, start reading it with them. And so I finished that book and then read Honest Money. And then once we, you know, we had some really good discussions over the course of about 8 weeks. And so once we finished those books, you know, I was just thinking, you know, we were in the middle of the pandemic, and I was thinking, well, that was cool. I mean, again, I didn't know anybody, and you know, just some kind of a nobody in the Bitcoin world, and so just had got to meet some of these people, and I was like, okay, well, that was crazy. But and then a couple of weeks later, a week or two later, I think George reached out to me and said, hey, we want to write our own book based on, you know, just kind of touching on a lot of these moral themes of money and just introducing the Bitcoin element. And so they're like, if you want to, you're more than welcome to. And so I ended up just deciding to do it. And so, yeah, so we just started, and it took about 6 months, all things told, meeting about once or twice a week. And yeah, it just was a really cool experience. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. How do you think it enhanced your own learning and understanding of Bitcoin and money?
Yeah. I mean, I've said this before. You've heard, I mean, the idea of like, don't meet your heroes. And so I just think like meeting, you know, people who, I mean, I knew Robert and Jimmy as, you know, personalities within the Bitcoin, but to talk with them and meet them on a more personal level was just so neat. And I just gained a ton more respect for them. And then obviously getting to meet these other people who we aren't as well known, on the, you know, popular level, but just, I mean, like all these people, I mean, Lyle and mean, Lyle's mind is incredible. I mean, like every tweet he puts out, I'm like, this is such value. Like, Kansas is free. Like, he's out there. I mean, Julia's been in this for a super long time. She's like lost a lot of awesome insights. Just like Jordan. I mean, all these guys, you know, Derek as well, he's got a whole different, you know, context from the real estate world. So I just think, I mean, I got opened up to a whole different world than I knew existed, you know, through talking with them. And yeah, just really, really grew to appreciate them. So,
yeah. I want to ask you about one of the parables in the book.
Sure. Yep.
For where your treasure is, there your heart will also be. Matthew chapter 6, verse 21. What does that verse mean to you?
Sure. Yeah. So basically, you don't have to read it, but like the right before that, he basically says, you can only serve, like, you can't serve two masters. So basically, and again, this is part of this, you know, ill-fated article I'm trying to work on, is basically like the scriptures lay out this idea that no matter what kind of political system you live under, like, your heart and your mind is a monarchy. Like, you have, there's one thing that will help order and subjugate the rest of your life. And so whether it's either God, like in this context, he lays out, it's either God or money. And there's one thing that's going to have your heart's allegiance that you're going to seek above all things. And whatever that thing is, that's in number, you know, in space one, you know, the first thing is going to order, you know, it's going to drive how much time you spend. It's going to drive, you know, what you do and why you do it and what you use. You're going to use everything else, you know, in two through whatever those spaces, you're going to use those things in service of whatever lives in that first space. And so, so to me, like I read that and I just, it's a sobering thing to realize, okay, something has this position of, this primary position in my life. And knowing that I'm going to use everything else that I have, my resources, whatever other resources I have, that's happening. So I look at it like, okay, which thing that, you know, God says this thing should be number one. And the question that I have to consider is that thing actually a number one? Or do I need to knock that thing out? You know, what do I need to do in order to get, you know, put myself in a position where I can have things in their right priority, you know, place? And that's a challenging thing. Like, honestly, like I've gotten to a place where, you know, over the last, you know, year and a half, like I was spending more time on Bitcoin than I needed to. I mean, it was getting to a place where, you know, I was spending more time and, I was spending a lot of time with that and not as much time, you know, like on other things that I needed to be, like, you know, my family and, you know, my wife, my kids, you know, like I was just, it's just so easy to pick up the cell phone and, you know, and to like, to be on Twitter and just, you know, to be learning and, you know, and then like, I mean, with this, you know, this newfound, you know, like my tiny amount of fame, you know, like, it's just so easy for that to be like this dopamine hit, you know, like, wow, there's these people out there who are benefiting from, you know, from these thoughts that I'm having, these work that I'm doing. I think that's another thing, like just constantly kind of trying to weigh these things. Like, do I have these things and where I say that I believe that they should be, you know, those kind of things. That was kind of how I see it.
That really struck a chord. I when I read the verse, which I read just directly from the book and just what I quoted, I saw it more as about skin in the game. And about if your money is in a good, fair thing, you're going to have a good, fair outlook. Yep. But what you just said struck a chord, because while I had skin in the game, I was putting all my mind share there.
Yeah.
And I think it was a good place to put my mind share versus maybe fiat, but maybe it took away from my family.
Yeah.
As many other things might. So I think that was really interesting.
And to that point, just, I mean, like what you're saying, like one of the, I'm reading this book and it's like a marriage book. And basically one of the things that he talks about that for me was just really convicting was, I mean, I've been sitting here and like thinking about, you know, about like investment, like money as an investment and Bitcoin as an investment. And like what this book talked about is like your marriage is an investment. It's like, you need to think about like the time and resources that you're investing in your, you know, your marriage or your kids, like those are investments that you're going to, you know, you're going to reap, you know, or harvest from those things in the future? You know, like you've, like, I mean, are your kids going to want to spend time with you? Like, is your wife going to be, you know, be there? Like those kind of things. And like, I mean, people go through horrible things. Like I'm not trying to, but like, I mean, just taking that thing seriously, taking that idea seriously of, you know, like your money is one investment and you should take that seriously. But like, you have all these other things that have been given to you that you're investing as well. And so just trying to, you know, make sure you're balanced in how you look at those things.
Yeah. The next one, I think you guys related to central banks, but again, I'll ask your opinion on what does it mean? Because obviously there's more to these things than I'm grasping at first cuff. So do not store up for yourself treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. Matthew chapter 6, verse 19.
Yeah. Yeah. And so like without, I mean, definitely like you see the danger of like, it, like why does money exist? You know? And like, if money is this place where you're like, I have to sacrifice everything in order to accumulate money. Like I'm willing to say, like in that time, like accumulating like gold and stuff was like, it's not, it was even more hard. I mean, this is like what happens in deflationary currencies. It's really, I mean, it's hard to accumulate wealth. It's a lot more difficult. And so if you're able to accumulate wealth, I mean, you're going to, in a lot of cases, like you're having to resort to a lot of like not good things in order to do it. You're going to have to, I mean, you're basically, you're having to resort to people. I mean, there's a lot of times where like there's slavery involved. Like there's lots of kind of things. And so for me, like, again, just even if it's not, even if that's not going on, if your primary thing driving you is I have to accumulate wealth, I have to find security in wealth. I have to find my, you know, I'm going to find my identity in being able to being the rich guy, and you're sacrificing the people and all these other things that are in your life. If you're sacrificing all those things in order to get, you know, wealth, like you're not being a human. Like you're living in service of something that isn't going to bring you the freedom that, you know, you're thinking it's going to, you know, seek out. And so again, I think that's a danger with Bitcoin as well. I think it is. I think for especially people who are in it, you know, who have gotten Bitcoin earlier, I think like the way that I think, like, I think about it, just, I see the Venezuelans, you know, I see the Venezuelans who are just having their purchasing power stolen away. And so I think about it on that level. And I think it's important for me. It's important for, I mean, all of us as Bitcoiners to keep our eye on the big goals here, which is for benefiting our neighbors and for benefiting people and not just making it rain and getting rich. Like we, you know, there's the scriptures talk about there being, I mean, I was just reading the other day, one of the people who served the early church, I can't remember her name. It's in the beginning of Romans. Basically, she was this wealthier woman and she was like a patron of the Apostle Paul's ministry. Like she was this lady who, you know, for whatever reason, if she inherited it or she had this really good business, she was a wealthier lady. And because of that, she was able to serve the needs, the physical needs of the church. And so again, I think it goes down to this principle of having things and using things rather than things having you. Mm. I think that's the thrust of, you just need to be careful and recognize the danger that's there when money's involved.
Yeah. I thought this one was going to be rhetorical, but as I'm reading it, I remembered that it's scratching an itch. So can a throne of destruction be allied with you? One which devises mischief by decree. Psalm 94, verse 20. And I'm wondering, you know, if you could relate this to maybe America today.
Yeah. Yeah. I just think like, I mean, like one of the things the scriptures talk about is like, to whom much is given, much is required, you know? And so like just the humility required, like, I mean, just that idea, like everything that you have is a gift, you know? And again, like that's, and like your life is a gift. And obviously, again, the first thing that leaps to mind again, because just working with people on a daily basis is like, well, then you have people who hate their lives, who go through tremendous suffering. And so again, like you don't want to minimize that at all, but just like so many of the things that we have, like the most important things we didn't choose, you know, like I didn't choose to be born. I didn't choose when to be born. I didn't choose my parents. I didn't choose to have a working body. Like all these things that we have, you know, like I didn't choose them. And so like if to apply it to America, like America has had this exorbitant privilege of having, you know, the stronger currency. And what did they do with that privilege that they had? They literally abused it by, you know, messing with the money multiplier and by, you know, stealing effectively from the rest of the world. They abused their right.
Are we all complicit? as Americans, even if we're Bitcoiners?
Yes. So I say yes on some level. I do not believe that we will all bear the same weight of guilt. Because again, like you have the, like Jesus talked about, like to one who, woe to the one who causes one of these little ones to stumble. And so basically it'd be better for that one to have a millstone tied around his neck and thrown into the sea. And so I do think, like, I mean, again, assuming that the events of, or most of the events of the creature of Jekyll Island are true, and this small group of bankers and politicians, you know, were behind, you know, a lot of that, like they will bear, like they will stand before God and will bear a much higher responsibility than the average person who doesn't understand these things.
And let me ask you a question about that. Yeah. Sorry to interrupt. Let's take someone like Bernie Madoff.
Sure. Yep.
But let's not get into Bernie. Yep. Let's say, you know, someone does a crime, and maybe there are people behind Bernie. I'm not getting to Bernie, but someone commits a crime and they gain a lot of wealth.
Yep.
And let's say through that wealth, they can send their children to the best educational institutions.
Yep.
And provide their children with the best networks and opportunities. Yep. And so maybe the father commits the sin, and maybe the sons and daughters benefit from the sin. But are we suggesting that it will catch up to even the second and third generation? Or is it possible that the father commits the sin and the kids go scot-free and they get to benefit from, even if, you know, they take the money away from the father at the end of the day, the children still have the job that they wouldn't have had, the education they wouldn't have had, the network, the support, sure, et cetera.
Yeah. And I think, but I do think that's true. I mean, I think this is horrible, but I can't remember the verse, but like someplace it's like later on in the Old Testament, like, cause again, like in the beginning, like God does hold the sins of the fathers against the children, basically to the second and third generation. Like he talks about that. And so, but then there comes a point, I don't remember, bad missionary, like where it comes to a point where he basically says, you know, I'm no longer going to do that. And so like, I look at it like, so again, so God himself is not like holding this specific over the father, like the sins of the fathers over the children, but just the practical consequences.
Yeah.
So like with Madoff, just use him as an example. So like his one of his sons commits suicide, right?
And so the other dies of cancer.
Exactly.
And on.
Yeah. So like, I mean, so again, at the very least, again, I'm not willing to, like, that's God, you know, I'm not willing to go there.
Right.
I just, we don't know. But like they bore the shame, you know, of the father, of the thing that they did. And so I think that's real.
Right.
So, yeah.
Okay. You know, in terms of when you hear the word money, and I ask this from, you know, not just an individual trying to bear the brunt of the world and figure things out, but and not just as maybe a family member who has friends and family come to them, but, you know, as a church pastor and maybe money comes up. So when you hear the word money, you know, what comes to mind and how does it make you feel and why?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing that comes to mind is probably just a tool, you know, like it's this tool that can bring, it can bring really a lot of good if it's used well, and it can also bring a lot of pain. we talk about this in the book, but just like, I mean, marriages destroyed, you know, like families split apart. I mean, just through whether it's having a lot of money or not having enough money, you know, like I can't remember whose podcast, I think it was, I was on Paul Miller about this. And one of the things that it's in one of the Proverbs or one of the Psalms, Psalms or Proverbs, he basically says, give me two things before I die. Don't withhold them from me. Give me neither poverty nor riches, like lest I have poverty and I steal and you know, basically give you a bad name, or if I have too much and I deny that I need you. And so I think that, I mean, both what you see there is both having and not having lots of money is a recipe for, you know, temptation, a recipe for heartache. And so I think, yeah, it's a tool that the thing where it's a tool and it's not everything. It's not the end all be all. It's a good tool, but it's not the reason to be alive. It's not the reason to despair. Like it's, and for those of us who have more money, like we have a responsibility to look for opportunities to serve others who are in a place where they don't have those kind of things.
Right.
So I would say probably a tool is the thing that comes to mind.
Yeah. And I think to kind of cap that off and really just even talk about maybe inflation, but, you know, one of the parables, bread gained by, Deceit is sweet to a man, but afterwards his mouth will be full of gravel. Yeah. That's the one that made me think of Madoff. Turning to more like, so, you know, counterfeiting is illegal. It's always been illegal. We live in this world where the government gets to counterfeit legally. But now there are repercussions to that. So, you know, another parable here from Genesis chapter 47, verse 15. When the money was all spent in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians come to Joseph and said, "Give us food, for why should we die in your presence?" And this, you know, I'll kick it off a bit. Like, it really rings to, you know, the winter is coming.
And now we're
in this situation. And this story, if I remember correctly, I mean, Joseph was sold into slavery by his brothers. And then works his, way up to vizier. And he actually provides great abundance for Egypt through his wisdom. And now there's a situation where, you know, the Pharaoh fucks it all up. And they come to Joseph. You know, it's kind of like, you know, Yellen and Powell fuck everything up and you come to Breedlove for the answers, you know. So what do you make of this parable?
Well, and again, I'll shout out, give credit where it's due. And like the rest of the authors would say the same thing. So Gary North, in his book, Honest Money, like talks about this passage, goes really in depth on it. And basically, so you have this situation where, again, like God gives, again, you can definitely tie Bitcoin. You tie, like, there's parallels there. So like God basically gives prophecy, like gives, you know, a dream to Joseph, where he basically shows Joseph, this is what's going to happen. And like, you guys better get ready, like get ready, start storing up food right now and get ready for this, you know, the bottom's going to fall out of this thing. And so, you know, he does that. And so then he's put in a place, you know, he's put in a place where he's able to, you know, benefit not just Egypt, but also, you know, the rest of the surrounding, you know, countries and stuff. And so, I do see parallels there between, you know, just the current situation in Bitcoin and just the whole world is in this bad situation where, you know, fiat money is literally going to zero and, you know, it's going to be a bad thing. It's going to be, people are going to be hurting. And, you know, right at this time, we have this thing that, you know, has the potential to just, you know, rescue, you know, the bond market and, you know, all these things that are otherwise going to straight, you know, just cause, you know, so much pain worldwide. I do think there are similarities there. And Bitcoin being personified, you know, as a type of Joseph, I do see the similarities there. That'll preach, Cedric. I do think like, there's comparisons to be made.
Yeah. I mean, before we turn to the church, which you guys get into in the back end of the book, another thing you guys wrote about was once community assets are captured, unfathomable abuses of power will occur. Taxing the rich is like a slave shaking down a slave. Can you maybe expand on that a little bit? Because I think that we're in this anxious time where, you know, the haves and the have nots, and maybe the have nots are going at each other a little bit.
I think one of the things, the principles that people talk about is like with Bitcoin and just with anything. I mean, one of the things that Jesus says, you're supposed to love your enemies, you know, and again, like what form that takes, again, you have to talk about that. But like, you love your enemies. And so one of the things that Pierre Rochard talks about is like, Bitcoin is for your enemies.
Right.
Bitcoin's for enemies. And so one of the things that, like, I just think like one of the reasons why we, like one of the reasons why we should want Bitcoin to have a bigger place of prominence is for the sake of our enemies. Like these politicians are just so, I mean, it's a miserable existence. Like they are so detached from the real life and what it really is supposed to be a human. Like these people know, like it's just power drunk, you know, money hungry, this whole thing. It's just miserable existence. And so again, obviously I know they're loving it in some sense, but like, I mean, this is not how God designed people to live, you know, where you're benefiting at the expense of all these other people. And so like, I think that, because I mean, fiat money just allows this, it's designed to be this money transfer from, you know, just the middle and poor people, middle class and poor people to the rich. And I mean, that again, like you look at, I mean, look at these families, like look at, I mean, somebody's like, you know, somebody who's just been in the news in the last few months is like Paris Hilton, right? I mean, she's like so rich. She's got so much money. She's got so much fame. And like, what happens to this girl? I mean, she goes through like super, just bad, a bad thing. I mean, just abused by people and just all kinds of stuff. I mean, all these celebrities, they're presented to us like, man, this is what we should want to be. We should want to have all this fame, all this money. And yet like you see these people left, right, and center, again, just suffering, you know, from like whether it's drug abuse or just loneliness or all these things. Like we were not made to be made much of by people. Like this is not a comfortable, this is not what we were designed to be. And so fiat money enables people to get to these unparalleled levels of wealth that just, you know,
that's interesting.
Result in not good things. So
that's really interesting. I go off a little bit on what Dave Chappelle says about celebrity, where, you know, the people that become celebrities are generally, you would think, are the most strong-willed, strong-minded, smartest, charismatic, these things. And then when they have these massive breakdowns or, you know, kind of catastrophic experiences, you wonder like what externalities broke them. Because his hypothesis is that they're not easily broken people or breakable people, whatever the verb is there. Yeah. But that something external happened to them, that you should not expect celebrities to be broken this easily like porcelain. And what that brings me to, I want to say, you know, falls under like, it came up with the conversation on Notice. So love thy neighbor. And what does that really mean? And I'm going to, you know, interject with Leviticus chapter 19, verse 36, under what you guys call it's just business. Okay. So, you know, you shall have just balances, just weights, a just ephah, and just him. I am the Lord, your God, who brought you out from the land of Egypt. So like, what is this? It's just business. And how has that affected us?
Yeah. So basically what, like just the idea of like, it's just business is this thing where it's just, you know, it's not personal. Like I'm using you. I'm like, I mean, Wall Street, like what happened with, it's one of my, I love the movie is The Big Short. Yeah. Like, I just love that movie. Like, it's, I mean, you see that, I mean, it's not personal, you know, we're just trying to make money. Like we're just trying to do this. And so it's just this idea that separate money from, you know, caring about people. Mm-hmm. Like it's that your intentions are all that ultimately matters. And these guys didn't have bad intentions. They're just trying to get money. And so, I mean, again, your intentions matter a lot. You know, Jesus makes that clear that, you know, that's at the end of the day, if you do all the right things, but don't have the right motives, like it doesn't, in God's eyes, like it doesn't serve for anything. But it's more than like, it's more than the intentions, you know? And so just the fact that, you know, this current system, I mean, it knowingly creates zero sum game, you know, zero sum games all over the place, you know, where, you know, it's altcoins, you know, like these altcoins, one person's going to win and one person's going to lose, you know, and fiat money, the rich will get richer. The hard assets will, you know, go to them, land, you know, all these things, they'll be able to accumulate them. And, you know, the everyday people will just get poorer and poorer and poorer. And that's just what's going to happen in the majority of the places. And so, and again, it's just business. You like, we want to just like rid ourselves, you know, the people who are in those positions, they don't want to carry that weight. But the reality is you do, you bear responsibility, you know, like that's the real consequences. You know, again, that's what, you know, that's the reaping of this, you know, the seeds that you know, that have been sown. And so again, do I think that these, you know, central bankers, you know, with the creature of Dragon, do I think that they ever could have imagined like the suffering that, well, no, I don't think that. I think they're, again, like the scriptures, like the idea of like sin, of like not loving your neighbor, not loving God, you know, doing things, you know, motivated by, you know, love of self at the expense of, you know, God and other people, like those things, it's short-sighted. You don't want to think about the consequences. You just like, I know that I want this thing that's right in front of me. And so like, that's just what's happened. That's what's happened. You know, fiat promotes and just, you know, propagates that line of thinking. I mean, Bitcoin by contrast, you know, promotes more longer time preference thinking. Like it's one of the coolest things to me is I was not expecting this at all. Was just like, you see Bitcoiners who like want to have kids and are like in a culture where the birth rate is plummeting, like Bitcoin seems like disproportionately like they want to have kids, they enjoy kids. And again, like there's a bunch of other things, but just our thinking, like I want to leave, I want to leave an inheritance, not just monetary. Like I want to leave, I want to invest in you know, the future of my country, or, you know, the world, my family. I want to think 100 years into the future, even if I'm not going to be here. And I think like that's like societies have to, I mean, like societies historically, you know, people, you know, most cultures began with religious beliefs. They have some sort of things. There's some God who is there at the end of the day, who I'm going to have to give an account to. And so like, it makes you think, it makes you prepare for that day. You know, I want to prepare. I'm a steward of things. I'm going to have to give an account for the way I live my life. And so that thought, again, that can be abused to be, you know, used to manipulate people, but even in the best case, like people, it's causing, hey, there's a day coming in the future and I want to prepare for it. I want to invest my life and the things that I have toward that goal. And I think Bitcoin really does help, you know, towards kind of restoring that more healthy line of thinking.
Yeah. That was awesome. Another thing I want to delve into is, you know, how bad money or fiat corrupts the church. I want to zoom out maybe more to the institutional versus the individual. And I want to, you know, touch that, you know, you said some very notable things at the top of the show where you try to spend less than you raised, give back more than you take, and these kinds of things. And it was really interesting. You know, Jimmy Song, again, I think it was on Stefan Lavera, talked about how, you know, that, you know, the opportunity for this, the money printer go burr and for the church to take out loans can kind of get the church a little ahead of itself. And now they got to manage the loan and the mortgage more than the congregation. And then you get all kind of externalities. I saw this a lot with temples where I grew up, where, you know, a lot of older congregants are leaving the state and the newer congregants aren't becoming congregants. You know, they have Yom Kippur fast, breakfast at a Chinese restaurant, you know, or whatever it is, instead of going to the temple. Yet the temple, the church has to service that mortgage. And then they have to turn to things like more like country club economics, like musicals and golf outings and fundraisers. So, you know, how do you think, you know, fiat has affected the broader institution of church? And how does that compare and contrast to, you know, how you're trying to be a church pastor, you know, and maybe as a Bitcoiner?
Sure. You know, I do think, I mean, it is like one of the things that, I mean, throughout like the, you know, Old Testament scriptures that you see is just like, you see God, one of the, he comes down, he basically says, I mean, there's lots of times where he says, basically, Israel, like you're acting just like the nations that are around you. Like you guys want to just imitate them. You guys just, it's kind of like what I did again, when I was in like middle and high school, was like, I just wanted to be one of everybody. I just wanted to be normal. You know, I want to have the things that my friends have. I want to be like them. And so, I mean, that's just always the, it's not fun to be. There's a lot of times where it's hard to be like the one who has higher standards, you know? And so the natural, so there's that, that's just, you know, normal societal pressures. And then I think, and so there's still like, there's responsibility there. And at the same time, so part of it is the responsibility falls on them. The other part is when you have institutionalized, you know, sanctified, you know, iniquity, like you have, I mean, like fiat money is this thing where it was made by a small group of people at the top, and then everyone else is made to bear the consequences. Like, yeah, I mean, just over time, the consequences get more and more dire. And so, I mean, yeah, it's, again, no one forces churches and synagogues to take out these, you know, to go into debt, to take out these expensive mortgages. Nobody, you know, so like that's, that responsibility falls on them. And yeah. And so like, you do have examples of that. I mean, I remember I attended a church in Tampa that was this big church that took out, you know, raised a whole bunch of money. They, you know, raised a big chunk of it and then just bought this humongous building complex and everything. And since then, this church has had gone through all kinds of different things because of the pressure that they felt in order to try to pay the, you know, cost for this building. And so the cool thing is, you know, for every church like that, maybe not for every, maybe there's probably one of what I'm about to describe for every 10 of those, you know, we have like our home church that again was this small church plant where we, you know, in the town where we lived in Florida. They basically, you know, they're in a different situation where they have just decided we're not going into debt. And so, you know, they have, you know, for 10 years that this church has existed, they have, you know, rented buildings and, you know, been able to set aside, you know, money to be able to try to, you know, eventually, you know, buy a building. And so again, so this is, I just love it because I mean, these people, again, these are some of the people who I just respect the most from, you know, as a Christian. I mean, I just look at their lives and I see these people are walking what they say they believe. And so again, and just seeing in a very holistic way, you know, these people were thinking long time preference. You know, they didn't want to just do what was normal and what was easy. But again, so that just doesn't happen a lot. And so I think that, you know, what's happening as a consequence is you're getting to a point like this, you have COVID hit and all of a sudden half your congregation loses their jobs. And all of a sudden you're in a lurch, you know, and you see the importance, you see the goodness of these things that God says, you know, where he talks about danger all throughout the Bible about danger, about debt being a dangerous thing. And one of the things you see is like, this is why, you know, like sometimes it takes hardship for us to see the why of why, you know, God or whatever, you know, if it's your parents or whatever, you have to go through the hard things in order to see the reasons behind these things.
Yeah. Another question you guys ask in the book that really struck a chord was how much human life has been wasted by bureaucracy created from fiat money.
Yeah.
And the related proverb here is, well, it's Proverbs chapter 13, 23. The fallow ground of the poor would yield much food, but it is swept away through injustice.
Yep.
And what do you, how do you relate to that in Bitcoin?
Yeah. I mean, again, just like one of the things I love, the images I love is again, this, I mean, what is a government supposed to do? And I just think like the government at this point has gotten so far beyond like what governments are supposed to do. I mean, just the basic thing of government is to provide a just atmosphere. You know, and like one of the things that again, this is, you don't see this practice very much in a lot of churches is, you know, like the idea is like the idea that most people have of churches is that they operate like this. The pastors do everything, like they do the ministering or the, you know, the priest, whoever it is, like they, the rabbi, they do everything. And yet like one of the things you see Paul talking about in the New Testament, is he basically says the job of pastors is to equip the people to do the work of the ministry. And so the idea is that like the people, they come and are trained. They're trained to take the message to their specific context. And they're the ones actually, making disciples, you know, whatever it is, like, you know, taking the message to those places. Because there's way more of them than there are the pastors themselves. And so I think I see a similar correlation between how government is supposed to work. The government is supposed to provide this, the parameters, whether, you know, like, with whether it's the doctrine, you know, or whatever, like these are the practices. This is the space that we're going to live and work in, but then have at it, like just go. And there's supposed to be a lot more freedom. And so I just think like the way, when you look at, you look at how, I mean, the government puts their hands in everything. Like there's taxes for everything. Like they just put their hands in every part of people's life. And what is the fruit of it? It bears injustice. Like it's injustice from the standpoint of like people, I mean, just the rich are taxed at like, I mean, rates that are, I mean, super high. I mean, just, so there's that. I mean, I don't think that's, you know, they've again, it's so hard to even talk about these things because of how much is mm-hmm. tied up with the fiat mm-hmm. side of things, mm-hmm. but just in general, like there's nothing wrong with, you know, with being rich. And so if you're just constantly reaching into somebody's pocket, like that's not good. At the same time, the poor are having their buying power, you know, stolen, right. just in increasing degree. And so like, that's horrible as well. And so, yeah. So, I mean, just where the rich knowingly use their power, you know, not to serve others, but to abuse others. It's horrible. It's a horrible situation. And Bitcoin basically, you know, restores everyone to one economic standard where everyone has to play by the same rules. I love the image. This was where I started. Like, I love this image of this. There can be a guy in the Philippines on an island, you know, some small little town in the Philippines who has internet, who can buy Bitcoin. Like, it's just incredible to me. You can buy like the hardest asset, you know, hardest monetary asset that's ever existed. He can sit there and he has the same opportunity as Goldman Sachs. You know, like it's just, mm-hmm. just that idea is just, it's just such a cool idea and such, you know, it's a just system. You know, there's only 21 million Bitcoin, but they're available to, again, they're available to anyone who has internet. Again, that's not a perfect system. You know, there's plenty of people who don't have internet, maybe who can't do that. But as far as like, when you compare that with the system that exists, it's a way more just system.
Right. My final question, I reserve to ask it in 27 parts and infinite follow-ups. You know, so just around family, you know, we talked a little bit about government and sort of the implications there. But, you know, we think we touched a little bit earlier, but birth rates are going down in every first world nation. And one of the biggest reasons is because children are seen as a bad trade-off. And I'm going to follow this up with a little bit of like, not only I think are children seen as a bad trade-off in today's times, but I also think that that humanity is almost renouncing its dominion. And the parable I'll read is from Genesis chapter 1:28. God blessed them and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over every living thing that moves on the earth.
I think that's part of it is, you have this on a lot of, you have identity crises happening at like every level of society, right? Like you have, there's so much questions of identity. Like there's like the identity politics, all those kind of things. And there's a lot of things. We're in this moment where we don't know who we are. We don't know what politics is. We don't know what, there's just so much upheaval that's going on. And authority, there's crises of authority, you know, like every level of governance, there's scandal, all these things. And yeah, we're at this place where, it's a very hard thing. People are like, don't know who to trust. They don't know what's real. The whole fake news. Everybody's just trying to figure out what is real, you know, like what is like, why am I here? These existential questions are being faced and, you know, where historically you have, you know, you go to your parents or you go to, you know, religious authorities, like there's crises in those places as well. I think the family is just one symptom of that. People things are getting more and more expensive. And so parents are having to work more and more and, you know, the communities are weaker than they ever have been, you know, like in the past, you know, maybe you'd have, a community of people that are strong, they have similar, whether it's, you know, religious communities or other things, you know, a lot of times their family would live nearby. And now just increasingly in the West, people live nowhere near their family. And so it just, everything's made a whole lot harder. You have to pay for things that historically your family would do for you. You know, like you know, your mom and dad could watch your kids. So you guys could go on a date, you know, and that would give you a little bit more margin as a couple. And now parents, you know, grandparents live far away or there's just all kinds of things that are consequences of, you know, fiat money and consequences of just these breakdowns and, you know, basic places of trust in society. And so I think, again, children are one evidence of that. And so what happens is you're going to have these cultures that are just ceasing to exist. You know, like if you don't value kids, eventually you will cease to exist. Like your people will cease to exist. And the people who do value them, they will be there. You know, and so this is why you see, and again, this is not like a judgment, just it's natural. Like in Europe, you have Muslim communities that are growing because Muslims, like they value children, you know, and Jewish families like value children. Christians, like they, you know, more than, you know, other people like value children. And so, those are still relatively stable, if not very healthy, you know, birth populations, but like where you see, you know, just statistically where you see those, you know, commitments decreasing and playing a smaller role, you see birth rates falling. And so like, again, I think that it's sad. It's interesting. I don't know how it's all going to work out. I do think it's forcing us to come to grips with these basic foundational questions, you know, who are we, why are we here? I think that's just a real thing that's going on right now that we're kind of living out and living in the midst of.
Right. So. Yeah. Not unusual for my show. We didn't go hard on Bitcoin because I think a lot of the things that we covered really underpin, you know, your views on Bitcoin and some of our views. And you know, usually at this point, I usually ask people like, what are the longer term outlooks? But I'm kind of curious to ask you what you think your shorter term outlook is for the greater world. Like, is it more tumultuous in 2021 than it's been? And, you know, and I'm saying historically speaking, I know it feels tumultuous, but you know, it's like fish and water. And how do you think maybe the next year or two is going to go?
Yeah, I think one of the things that is difficult is it's difficult again. One of the reasons why it's hard to kind of orient ourselves and figure out like what's real is because like with technology, everything is just immediately right in your face. Like there's things that happen in, you know, on the other side of the world, and all of a sudden, like I mean, like the again, no crazy, like the Black Lives Matter protests, like stuff happens to like a guy in the United States dies, and then literally around the world, there's like there's people saying that guy's name 2 days later. I mean, it's just incredible, just the phenomenon. And so, but like one of the things is when you just realize, when you look at the statistics of things like violence, you know, like they're actually all going down. Like they're, I mean, murder rate is like down. It's like going, it's being statistically going down over the last 20 or 30 years. But our eyes and our experience are telling us something very different.
Right.
And so I think like that's part of, I mean, on a lot of levels, things are getting better. I mean, people are more aware of things. And at the same time, like the roots that are underlying a lot of these things are just disappearing. And so again, what happens, and again, just you go look at, I think a tree, Psalm one talks about, he says, like, blessed is the man who like walks not in the counsel of the wicked and nor stands in the way of sin. Like basically compares people to trees. And he basically says like the man who doesn't walk in the counsel of the wicked, the man who is living to, you know, to honor God and to take care of people, he's like a tree planted by streams of water. And so basically a tree planted by streams of water has this constant, has the constant nutrients. It's able to grow strong roots that go deep that allow it to survive, you know, storms or whatever, earthquake, whatever it comes, it's more likely to be able to do those things. And so on the surface, it looks like we're in a very good place. And in some ways we are, but the roots underneath those things, I think are weaker. I think are very weak. And so, I mean, I just think politically there's so much dissension. There's a lack of trust. I don't know. I honestly don't know. You know, I could, again, sometimes I was just listening to another like pastor talking about these things. It was just like a lot of times in the scriptures, when things look the darkest, like God, you know, with the Israelites are getting ready to cross the Red Sea. And right as they get to the Red Sea, there's this Red Sea before them. What are we going to do? We turn around and we see the Egyptians coming at us. It's like, what in the world? We're dead. You know, we're cooked. And then God, you know, basically just waits until the last moment and then, you know, delivers his people. So that's what I'm praying for, like, would love to see happen. And at the same time, like sometimes, you know, we go through hard things and we have to go through hard things in order to realize, you know, in order to come to convictions about those core beliefs, and see their importance. I think they've been taken for granted for a long time. I don't know. I honestly don't know. Said I'm no prophet on these things, but
I hear you. I just wanted to get your sentiment. You know, I get what you're saying. It's sometimes it's darkest before the light.
Yep.
And you really don't know if it's going to get darker or brighter, if you're in that final darkness or not, you know, but I've really appreciated this conversation. This was really deep and meaningful for me. I've enjoyed this immensely. I'm going to leave it to you for any parting words. I hope we covered a lot of ground that you were interested in. And if you have any parting words, and definitely let people know where they could find you.
Sure. Yeah. So the first thing I want to say is just, I mean, again, I try to say this and every time it's like, thank you to Jimmy and Derek and Robert and go find all these guys. Their names are, I mean, if you have the book, go buy the book. Like, thank God for Bitcoin. You got a copy right there. Yeah. So yeah. So go get that. We've been having all kinds of trouble with it. Look at the notes, man. We've been like having all kinds of trouble getting the Audible version like up and running. They keep making hard on us. So it should be up there any day now. But go get that. And then again, like I said, Jimmy and Robert and, you know, Derek and George and Gabe and Julie, Julia and Derek, I think that's everyone. Just super thankful to them. Go check them out on Twitter and find their stuff. They're putting out good content. I'm just, again, super thankful for you. I've really appreciated following you on Twitter and, you know, just seeing the stuff that you post and the people you give voices to. I mean, again, I saw you've been posting several clips of that conversation you had with, Katie, the Russian, and Jimmy and
from Thanksgiving. Pierre. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I just appreciate a lot of those guys. If you're interested, I think I can say this, that we're going to do beginning of April, we're going to do like a book release, book celebration party. And so we're going to do that in Austin. It's going to be Austin on the, let's see, what is it? The 7th, I think, is the night, the 7th of April. We're going to go to Fogo de Chao and they're in Austin. And they basically, I wasn't going to be able to come just because like, it's just hard and like flights are expensive. And so they are super generous as they decide to fly me up there. So I'm actually going to be there and get to meet all of them in person for the first time. And get to meet. Yeah. So I'm looking forward to that. Getting to meet Pierre. I really respect him. And so I'm looking forward to meeting him as well. So yeah. So if you guys were able to come, you guys live in Austin or nearby, you can come. That'd be cool to see you guys.
Yeah. I'm not near there, but I might make it over there. So please include the details. I'm very interested in visiting Austin soon. I'm going to front the book. Thank God for Bitcoin. I think it's fabulous. I don't see it. You know, I just think it was an awesome book, kind of like Ethics of Money Production. It really kind of, it just goes over the history of money. What is money and why it's important and the morality behind it. It's rooted in Judeo-Christian values. And I just thought it was fantastic. Your co-authors, Robert Breedlove, Gabe Higgins, George McHale, Lyle Pratt, Jimmy Song, Julia Turanowski, and Derek Walchek. I don't think I got Julia's last name right. But I did the best I could very quickly, but I think it's fantastic. And I've appreciated this so much. I'm going to have George on soon in about a month to talk about the book too, as well, and his experiences. Awesome. And I'm very excited for that, but I digress. Thank you, Jordan. This was so dope. I really appreciated this.
Man, really appreciate it. Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you.
Jordan Bush on the creation, corruption, and redemption of money right here on the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And thank you for listening. If you enjoy these conversations, please subscribe and give a 5-star review wherever you listen to your podcasts and share with your friends and family. That's the best way to spread the word, the Bitcoin way. This is Cedric. Peace.